Was macht denn der da?
Design.
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 Machen.
Machen. Machen.
Gesellschaft.
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 Gesellschaft. Gesellschaft.
Liebe ZuhörerInnen, bitte erschreckt nicht, die heutige Folge des IDR Design Forschungspodcasts Design macht Gesellschaft wird heute in Englisch stattfinden, denn heute haben wir zu Gast Michael Majes und Stephen Neely, mit denen ich, Arno Görgen, über ihr Buch Somesthetic Design, The Experiencing Body and the Dynamics of Time, erschienen dieses Jahr im Transkript Verlag, sprechen wollen. So, now we'll switch to English. I just explained to our listeners that this very episode will be in English, and because we want to talk with you about your book. First of all, welcome to Design Macht Gesellschaft, the design research podcast of our little Institute for Design Research at the Academy of the Arts in Bern, Switzerland. And just to introduce you both, Michael teaches in the information design and data visualization and experience design programs of the Northeastern University in Boston, if I'm right, where he's also an associate professor of design in the Department of Art and Design and the director of Health and Wellness Design Lab. Welcome, Michael.
Glad to be here.
We actually have the Swiss Center for the Swiss Center for Design and Health in Bern in Switzerland too. So this might be a very similar institution. Maybe we can talk about it later. And Stephen Neely is a teacher, a theorist and a clinician who lectures and presents workshops in the fields of design, music, architecture and, a difficult word for me, pedagogic. For the German speakers, and he also is the Milton and Cynthia Friedman Associate Professor of Music and Director of the Graduate Studies in the Carnegie Mellon University School of Music in Pittsburgh, in Pennsylvania. Welcome.
Thank you. So nice to be here.
This might be a little bit reductive in our presentation. Maybe you both can tell us a little bit more about your academic background. Well, you do really a lot, it seems to me, and how you both ended up in writing this book together.
Would you like to start? Or?
Sure. I'm Stephen, and I've been a longtime music faculty, music professor, performer here in the Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania area for many, many years. My primary focus of study is in music under the heading of Dalcroze Eurythmics. And so it's an embodied music, musicianship, artistry training where we use body and motion as the model for artistry. And many years into my career, it occurred to me that that same training was important or applicable outside of music as much as inside of music. And so I went looking for a new field of study that where I could talk about embodied experience outside of music, but with music as the inspiration. And I found my way to the Carnegie Mellon School of Design, PhD in design, where I studied experience design as my primary focus. And that's where I met Michael.
Yes, we met in the first year of the reinvention of the program under Cameron Tonkinwise, who's now teaching in Australia. Kind of this underlying question, I think Stephen pointed out very early in the program. I think this was maybe 2014 or 2015. That design does not have a great language to deal with temporal experience. There's words like desire or anticipate or expect, and these sort of like smuggle in this time-based understanding, but we really don't think about the temporal experience of using a product or experiencing a service in the same way that we do the formal visual structures or formal structures.
Would you say this might have changed a little bit since, I don't know, start of the 90s, when the digitization of societies really got a grip on the societies and also changed the way that we interact with, for example, computers, with digitized surfaces, all this stuff that really changed our way that we also experience, there is the word again, the world.
That point actually became a lot of the focus of the book, where we have many new technologies that are claiming the body as a relevant player of experience, and yet not a really great discussion or vocabulary or even understanding of what is an experiencing body. So we have many data points that grab and point at and touch bodies, but don't yet describe the actual aesthetic of experiencing. And so what we've attempted to do through the research and the writing of the book is to try to point out what is the actual human interaction, different than the digital or the snapshot sort of recording of data points that is so easily, easily recorded or so easily grabbed. We're trying to talk about the lived, personal, human version of time and temporality, different than a disembodied kind of reckoning of data points.
Well, and Stephen brings up that word snapshot, and I think that really figures very prominently in our critique of how interaction design, how these digital systems are designed today, is kind of with this snapshot mentality, right? You think of the, any designer who's working in an experience design practice, they'll map out the different screens that someone will experience as they move through an app or through a website or through a supposedly interactive experience. But these are like static vignettes that happen, maybe they move through some very quickly. Maybe they spend some time considering on others, but they're all put at the same level and treated with the same level of care. Whether it's a rapid gesture through many screens, quickly, like maybe checking out in a shopping cart is a kind of a mundane example, or a time when you might spend more time at a given screen, carefully considering options. This really, this kind of thinking of the pacing of the experience is not really part of the vocabulary.
It also seemed to me that by what you explained in your book, that the idea of a moving body that is more than just the moment in which it interacts with an object didn't really take place in design studies until maybe recently, I don't know if it even started yet or if you introduce something totally new.
We believe rather new sets of ideas, or maybe just newly described sets of ideas, is the encouragement to view experience not as Michael was saying, snapshots or discrete moments. For instance, on a branch chart where we would see a flow chart where we would see event number one and then a little line and then event number two and then a line and event number three. As a more common way that these types of things have been described, but rather to view all experience as aspiring to gesture. So something that has a beginning, it has a gate, it has a rise, it has a fall. So we describe this concept of shift of weight throughout the book, which is just a way of trying to pull the reader into this understanding that all experience can be when it's actual felt experience. We don't experience or live instants. We live gestures that have organic beginnings and mounting or climax and organic resolution. And the tighter we are able to map our designed experiences to those natural gestures, then the more the soma aesthetic, that is the actual feeling of the body, can be pulled in, rather than the opposite, which is if you can't create gestures or be involved in a gesture, then the design act actually amounts to a disembodying, an actual breaking of the soma aesthetic, rather than a pulling in.
I mean, I'm a cultural historian with a strong research interest in game studies. And all the time I have to think of Ian Bogost's procedural rhetoric concept. He talks about rhetorics in the sense of that until, again, the digitized age, we have a rhetoric that takes place more or less static with a fixed static text, for example, or a visual, or be it a sound that cannot be changed. And for example, games change that in a way that they try to convince, in the sense of rhetorics, the player by letting him play a system, or introducing him to the procedural or systemic aspects of specific actions and how to understand the systemic qualities of each game. And this is something that reminds me very strongly of what you are proposing here, only that you have a very, very strong focus on the physical or corporeal qualities of design in this case.
The physical is absolutely front and center. We do make an attempt to point out that while there are external gestures where I can actually lift my arm and move it through space, that same motion, that same gesture is also can be experienced inner. And so the literal suspending of weight when I pick up my foot to walk forward, I also can feel concretely just on the inside of me sitting still, if I'm involved in an experience. You know, just as I hear you complete your sentence speaking, in your sentence, I'm suspended waiting for my foot to hit the ground as you complete your idea. And so we're trying to point out both sides are quite relevant, that we have a model for actual literal physical participation, external gross motor bodied participation. And then we can recognize that same inner gesture that matches as we just develop the literacy to understand that we are always involved in gestures, whether the gesture is external or internal.
You start your book with a wonderful example, the Life Gear by Texas Instruments from the year 1993, and you describe it as somehow being the birth of experience design. Can you maybe tell us a little bit more about the Life Gear? Was it some kind of augmented reality show, or what did it really make so revolutionary for you?
Well, I hope we didn't say the birth of experience design, but there were a number of people working at the same time, and kind of this idea was very very timely. And I would say there's a confluence of people who were all working on this together. I do think the Live Gear project was kind of one of these strategic design moments in a company when there's the organization senses that there's a future that they might be able to connect with if they make some moves within the company. And so they were able to bring together Fred Morrell, who was the design director for Texas Instruments at the time, brought in a variety of designers, and one of who we had the opportunity to work with during our PhD, Terry Irwin, was part of this group that came together to rethink what computing could be. And, you know, in these early 90s here, they were really thinking about computing as mobile, computing as experiential, computing as providing, you know, so many of the opportunities that we see today and just quite take for granted. what they were able to do that was also so transformative was they were given the space to use of this quite large conference room, conference area, about 3,000 square foot, and they created like a maze of panels to create different rooms in different areas, and they had their young designers act as tour guides through this visualization of the future, of what how Texas Instruments technology could be embedded in different situations. And I know it's in these days of like RFID tags and mobile computing and geopositioning technologies, even in a pallet that moves freight around the country, like these things are just the quotidian normal situation today, but in 1993, thinking of computing in this way as being able to facilitate an experience rather than being a product was quite revolutionary.
Actually reminds me a little bit of visions from cyberpunk novels that we had at the time and a little bit time before. I'm not sure if there was any influence between literature and design. Would be interesting to look at, but there seems to be somehow a discourse that exactly transported these thoughts of a quotidian and ubiquitous digital design and product design that really accompanies people through their everyday life.
Yeah, I do know Fred Morell was quite interested in the writing of science fiction writer Bruce Sterling, at the time, and also William Gibson, who is, although I don't think Live Gear had any opportunities for you to jack in to the network in the way Gibson thought.
And like with today's tech pros, they maybe didn't see the negative aspects in the novels, but try to focus on the ideas and the innovations that they presented in literature, if there was any communication or information transfer that went from one thing to the other. So thank you for telling us a little bit about the Live Gear. I personally also like the way that you guide readers through the book and take time to explain the individual concepts, for example, of the body or of time, which are not dealt with a lot in design studies, for example.
Yeah, we believe very much the same. And with so much, the encouragement to keep writing is just the more we tried to describe to ourselves the version of time that we thought was important and the version of body that we thought was relevant for designers, it just seemed more and more proven that those definitions were uncommon in many of our design schools. There certainly are many, many brilliant design educators all over the world who are looking in the same directions as us. But there had yet to be a sort of agreed upon, volume that tried to lay it all out in one place and sort of claim these definitions. And so we thought that that was something that we could do. Again, just to repeat something that we said 10 minutes ago, when we say the word time, it's so commonly just thought, I don't know, stopwatches and clocks on the wall, as that's what time means. And when it comes to lived experience, the actual participatory experience, very little of our participation is characterized by so many seconds. Instead, it's characterized by anticipation, by yearning, by desire, by rest or comfort, resolution, tension and release, those types of versions of time, which is so different than my little app on my watch clicking how long I slept last night. It is not the same idea, and so easily confused. It's so easy to mix up those definitions. And so we tried very hard to say we're not trying to talk about Chronos time. We really want to talk about the kairotic, and the felt yearnings, leanings toward resolutions as the version of time And then the same thing with body, and that ergonomics has been a major theme in many different versions of engineering and design education for a long time. And yet the exact sizes of bodies and the, you know, the kind of affordance of my wrist or of my elbow, you know, those kinds of anatomic descriptions of bodies, while really important, are not really the version that we are thinking is so relevant for this Soma aesthetic agenda. And so again, it's the body that is wrapped up in the felt. It's the body that yearns and leans and moves in gestures rather than in discrete choreographies.
Well, and that reminds me too that maybe we didn't talk too much about our positionality in relation to time at the beginning of this recording. And so Stephen and I are both from the United States, of course, and both, you know, very Stephen's background, I suppose I should let you talk about it, but based in Western music and, you know, kind of a European tradition of a temporal understanding. And so there's, you know, many concepts of time that also exist in different cultures that, you know, I think maybe this book is only the first book that talks about this bridge between design and time. And maybe we don't capture every time that exists in the many different cultures that think of different kinds of Aboriginal time or time as a feminist construct, or time as, you know, there are so many nuances within this concept. I think we offer a vocabulary for working with design in the context of, you know, producing technological products in this kind of society in which we live.
I found one footnote particularly interesting.
There were lots of footnotes. Our designer our book layout designer was only a little frustrated with how many footnotes we had.
Actually, it's a very German thing to have thousands of footnotes. So for me, it wasn't a problem at all. But there was one footnote I found interesting, and in it you write that experience design is for everyone with a beating heart and breathing lungs. And I was just wondering why you left out the brain, which is, after all, the very heart of all cognitive experience. Although this might, of course, only be a tiny detail in your text, it might be an important observation, given that you state that all design is experience designs, right? Or maybe I pose this question differently. In how far does the differentiation between cognition and experience play a role in how you see Soma aesthetic design?
There's a whole can of worms here, Arno.
Well, we wrestled with this and how to describe this throughout the whole project. I mean, for 5 years, we've wrestled with how to both say that there is a body that is not the same thing as a mind, and at the same time, not allow there to be a difference between mind and body. And we very much struggled and tried. So we try to state clearly that there is only the body hyphen mind, and maybe other times we rearranged it and said mind hyphen body. So there is no actual separating of the two. You can't be only mind and you can't be only body. However, you can prioritize or focus on one more than the other. And so, which is a sort of willful act. So what we are is mind bodies or body minds. We are holistic entities, but our training and our biases can be so large or so loud that we forget to engage with half of who we are. And so it's possible to get stuck in our minds and ignore the body. And in fact, much of modern technology encourages that, really trying to distance us from the experiencing carriage. And then there are other cases where the body is doing its own thing and we're not even cognitively aware. The goal is to be integrated, to be whole. But we definitely spend more time talking about the body and Soma aesthetic because so much of particularly Western culture has prioritized the thinking side, oftentimes to the exclusion of the experiencing physical side. How's that, Michael?
Oh, that's great. And I would say even, you know, this situation that we're in right now, you know, we're both kind of crouched over our computers, you know, keeping very still. So, you know, this design of a computing situation really is, I don't know, I don't want to say hostile to the body, but it sure doesn't incorporate the body, even, you know, kind of more active, the design of a driving, you know, the design of driving a car, you're hurtling down the freeway at, what, you know, 80 kilometers an hour in Germany. Maybe we're at 65 miles an hour in the United States. But, you know, it's the same design, right? We've been designed to stay still, to make minor motions with our hands and fingertips, maybe. There's really not an engaged, embodied experience designed into that experience. And we think that's a missed opportunity. It's a missed opportunity to engage the whole self.
Yeah, maybe this is a good point to go to my next question. As I told you, I'm situated in the history of the digital society in game studies, in what games brought to us in the 80s and how it shaped our lives. And I, well, game studies, well, the field I mainly work in mostly lacks this contact of a somatic aspect of gaming somehow, because the immersion within games somehow conceals the interacting body, the real body, because in the act of playing, the body is enhanced in the virtual experience of the game, right? And I also have the impression that players are not interested in real embodied experience. There's this example that, for example, they are satisfied, or they like the, for example, the force feedback controls of a game where it vibrates a bit if some action happens on screen. And on the other hand, the for 30 years promised VR revolution still doesn't take place, especially not in gaming. And what I ask myself is, how much of a utopia is this Soma aesthetic design that you propose? Because it's a very optimistic theoretical perspective on its uses. Also, maybe an ideal future of how we could see the interaction of body, of the designed object. But where are, in your opinion, the limits of your perspective that you offer?
Oh, I don't know how optimistic. I think it's, you know, there's perhaps no option to not include it, you know, because if, you know, by the current, you know, the current design really neglects the Soma aesthetic. And then we find out that, oh, well, now we have repetitive stress injuries or carpal tunnel syndrome in our wrists because they were, you know, at an angle the whole time we were typing for years and years, instead of thinking of a design for a computing interface that would more deeply engage the body. And I would say this is just maybe one piece of this argument. And another piece of it is we don't think about, we've left undesigned, like the arc of time that you experience a computing device. So maybe it starts out pretty much the same as it ends. You know, I don't know if you've ever, you know, you open your email at 8 a.m. to start answering emails. It's the same, you know, it's the same feeling as answering emails at 1700, but your body has changed, but the email has not. You know, it doesn't reflect that that arc of experience. You have it, but the design doesn't. The design doesn't engage it. It's almost like we would try to design a 2D poster and not consider the difference between a circle and a triangle and a rectangle, or different typefaces or different colors.
Just to add to that, we are very interested in the external, muscled, overtly gesturing body as a instrument, as a actual aesthetic tool, as an example of the participatory body, but it is not at all the only example. We value the inner motion at least as much as the outer motion. And so I think VR is certainly still an exciting promise that maybe will turn into something, you know, really great in the future, but it isn't at all the mark of embodied or disembodied. We can have an embodied experience gaming or talking to each other if I'm just aware of the suspension and the excitation and the release of energy as I build toward and away from moments. And so a big part of the book says a couple different places through the book, tries to describe to the reader that the body, the engaged body or the embodied experience is working on this cycle. We use the wording anacrusis, crusis, metacrusis, or this idea of leaning toward and away from moments of crusis or moments of instance. And again, I can do that externally by leaping or running or jumping or swinging my body in some way. I can also do it, I can experience it sitting still as I listen to you finish your sentence, or I watch the graphic move toward and away from some moment. And so the Soma aesthetic designer is aware that the animation isn't just a bunch of instant pictures, but it creates motion, or should, or aspires to create motion in the participating body. So going to the cinema and feeling the drama mount and build toward a moment is absolutely Soma aesthetic, even if I am sitting still in my chair in the dark. So we're spending at least as much time trying to get the reader to recognize when the body is engaged in all its opportunities, not only when it's literally jumping up and down.
Yeah, it seems a little bit to me that, also I love the idea, and also how you describe it and how you introduce the reader to this concept. It seems to me that on the practical side, this would need a lot of more effort, or data might be the wrong word, maybe knowledge from experience, maybe, to implement a Soma aesthetic design into one's own practical form of design that you do it at your job or at the university or wherever.
Maybe, but I think like the good work is already doing this. You know, you mentioned video games before. I mean, I've played games where, you know, maybe a first person shooter game where you're like walking down the hallway in a building and you know some, you know, other, the non-player characters are out there looking to shoot you, you know, or whatever, attack you, whatever will happen. And you're just going down so slowly, looking around the corners, wait, and then that thing happens that you hoped wouldn't happen, and you feel it, you know, you feel it in your body. So I think a good game, you know, video game designer is thinking about, oh, I'm going to stretch out this moment and make it very suspenseful. And there's this jeopardy, you know, too, that you might be feeling. I think IKEA does this really well. The store itself is designed as a temporal journey that you move through, you know. It's a friction, you know, a friction that, you know, holds you back, that makes you look through all the merchandise that they have. Maybe it's a bit extractive sometimes when you end up with your cart too full of Swedish meatballs and plants and extra towels that you didn't plan to buy. You know, I think the good work is already doing it. They're just doing it unaware, or without the vocabulary.
Would you say that you propose a, maybe it's a too strong word, a paradigm shift from a maybe forced environment to more organic environment, in the sense that organic, that you're you use the word holistic in your book, that you are connected to not only the product itself, but to many points in really in your environment, to the weather, to your daily mood, to the temperature in the room, to how comfortable the chairs you sit in, all these things that come together in this very specific situation that you're in when interacting with a designed object.
Yeah, so this is really much of the challenge, and maybe much of the frustration. And in a different description of experience design, in a different pedagogy, a different training, you might just think, no, I will design this environment. I will tell you all the lighting, and I will get the chairs in the right place, and I will design the path. And so I've covered it all. But true Soma aesthetic design acknowledges there are so many things out of our control. And so we can't force a specific feeling on anyone. We can estimate who our people are, who our users are. We can estimate what their demographics are. We can think about how able-bodied they are and what age they are and what cultures they're likely to come from. And so what things might make more sense. But it's always personal. And so, I believe we do find a couple places to say we can't guarantee, no designer can guarantee a certain reaction or a certain walk away from some set of designed variables. What we can do, though, is critique it after the fact using a shared vocabulary. We can reassess the design based on these fundamentals versus other fundamentals. For instance, the difference between gestures and flow charts, right? So rather than a series of instants and did the design do that, we can ask, well, yes, there were those instants, but what were the motions that led anyone to and through those instants, and try to revalue the design through the personally experienced body rather than the logical arrangement of snapshots. So those are things that we think this kind of training or this sort of thinking, you know, might reveal to a designer. But it's definitely not easy, or not easy to guarantee.
I was wondering too, like if you have the bit that you say sometimes, Stephen, on attentional hierarchy. And maybe this is part of the answer to Arno's as well.
I don't know how well, I'm not sure attentional hierarchy made it into the book. Maybe it did. I might have to go back and look, but it definitely influenced the book. So one of the things I have spent a lot of time thinking about is how experience, certainly, well, maybe all experience is never one thing. There's multiple things happening at once all the time. And so I'm sitting in this chair, but I hear the hum of my refrigerator, and I know my wife is in the next room, and I'm worried that my dog is about to bark, and I'm talking to you, and I'm out here with Michael. And we could keep on going of all the different threads that are apparent in my world right now. All these things are happening. I default to a certain ranking of those variables. So this variable right here isn't at the top of my attention. It's down here, but still present in my life, but it's lower. And so my history and my culture and my ableness, my age, my personal body, all of those help determine my attentional hierarchy. What's at the top of my attention and what is lower down to the point of forgotten or, you know, not aware. And we all default to that. We have our own defaults. Soma aesthetic design can aspire to rearrange our hierarchy. We can train someone to take the thing that they normally push down and get it to be a higher on their attentional relevance. And so we can design training in. And we can actually, before that, we can just acknowledge that everybody who shows up to my experience today, they won't all rank them the same. I think this is the most important thing that everyone's going to notice, but actually somebody with a different body and a different history, they flip it and they're paying attention to something else. And so again, there's no way to guarantee that everyone will feel it the same. However, with training and with sort of thoughtful design, we can little by little try to pull people's attention to certain threads of the discourse and little by little show them merits in rearranging their hierarchy. And so, and that kind of thinking was a part of Michael's and my discussion for the whole project. Almost from the very beginning, we were noticing that attention is, or experience is, never one thing. It's always embedded in multiple threads. And that accounts a lot for how we all can walk away from the same experience thinking differently about it.
And I think how Apple handles the design of the smartphone OS is kind of an example of this neglect. You know, they're very good at many things, but you know, thinking about, well, like Stephen was saying, if you think about the smartphone just as a little ecosystem, you know, maybe it has on their Instagram, and if I was younger, a TikTok and Snapchat and you know, email conversation from work, as well as like personal things that I'm interested in. And those have a hierarchy, and perhaps I would like to rearrange the hierarchy of how I get notified of, you know, an update on, you know, from a personal friend versus a message from work about something I need to do before the end of the week. Right now, these are all treated as a flatness. They're all given the same emphasis. Within a few parameters, we can adjust them, maybe the type of notification we get or how long it stays on the screen. But the phone really doesn't think about learning or think about architecting or think about maybe poetics with how it tells me what's going on in that little ecosystem that I'm of my attention.
Would you say that's maybe the most difficult part in this, that you, if you want to, for example, do somaesthetic design for the masses, that there is a point on which you have to neglect or at least put an average line on how people experience things?
So I think you can come at it from a couple directions. One would be a kind of more traditional industrial design, there's one chair that has to fit everyone kind of perspective. And so to the extent that we make one app that works one way, or we make one path through IKEA that is a certain length and has a certain, or, you know, then in those cases, it's the same as the chair in that it's only going to fit one out of 1,000 people really well, and everybody else, it's a major compromise. There's a different way of reading the book, which is maybe less about what is the one design you will create that everyone will participate in equally. And instead, you can read the book to think, oh, just how do I analyze a design that is in process, some experience that someone is having, which is allowed to then be extremely unique. And then we can just say, oh, it really met that person where they are, or it did not. And so, you know, or the five different people I'm following through Disney World had five very different experiences, and why, you know, what added to it being more productive for one and less productive for another, because they all had a unique path. They all did different things, and somebody walked away very happy and somebody was very tired. And we can think, well, if we think of it soma aesthetically, what were the gestures they were involved in? How did they rank their attention? What was the role of the inner motion versus the outer motion? We have a whole chapter on the N kinesthetic. The chapter 5 is the shared experience and sort of the power, like the really profound strength or power of being in motion with others. And so we can look at any individual's experience, whatever the experience is, and think, well, to what extent were they engaged with another, which can be another person, or it can be a thing, or it could be an app, or it could be an environment. But to what extent were they actually able to entrain to the other, the environment, or to the thing, or to the other person? And to what extent were they fighting that entrainment? They were never able to sort of land shared motion. So I think you are exactly right, and that if we are to come up with a single design for any given moment or event, it's going to miss most people's perfection, and it's always a compromise. And then, but that isn't the only value of this rant, or the only thing the rant might point out.
And I would even say too, you know, AI, you know, as much as I'm like sick of talking about and hearing about AI, I think there are some opportunities. And like what Stephen just said is that, you know, when you consider AI as a possibility and how that technology might learn to serve our needs better, our book is directing us towards maybe what we should be paying attention to, rather than, and what maybe the AI should be learning in order to better optimize. So for a variety of bodies, a variety of experiences, and a variety of situations too, because it's not just, you know, this somesthetic design is not just based on your body, but it's also based on the context within which you're having that experience. We write, there's a section in there where we write about Heartbreak Hill. In the Boston Marathon, they write about Heartbreak Hill. My daughter was practicing soccer very near there, and I brought the dog along, and I went out for a little run, and I ran up that part of the road, and I got to the top, and there was a big sign that says Heartbreak Hill, and I thought, huh, this is not even a hill at all, you know. Well, the reason it's Heartbreak Hill is it's in the, I think, in the 20th mile of a 24-mile run, you know, and it's after two other hills and then a very long downhill that just drains all the energy from your legs. So that it's, you know, this kind of like mild 2% grade is really not that significant. But in context, that experience is intense, you know. So I think this is the opportunity is to be able to direct AI, you know, or to direct a learning type of interface, not just towards learning these, you know, these body parameters, but like also learning the context of the situation.
Maybe this is a good final point, phrased differently. The book gave me a lot of stuff to think about. Again, I liked how you took the reader by the hand and guided us through this land of somesthetic design and introduced a new perspective that might be interesting to also include into your work and to give a fundamental basis for reflection on what you're actually doing. So I really think this is a topic that we should use, talk about a lot more in design studies. And yeah, thank you for having you here, for talking about this. And I'm interested, maybe last point, I'm interested where you're going from this point in the to the future. What's your plan with somesthetic design yourself? Are you planning on new projects, or is the book finished and now you can finally get on to other things?
Well, we're definitely taking a little breath. It's been a good amount of work for about 4 or 5 years straight here. And we're really, I think the next round is just engaging with people like you, our colleagues from around the world, and seeing which of the ideas resonate and which of the ideas people want to fight about. I think the next round is a whole nother round of research as we just engage with a wider community where we will continue to learn and be able to refine the ideas and learn from others. And then I think we're hoping to collaborate with industry and with academics and, you know, just find ways to continue the conversation. Michael, did you have other thoughts there?
I'd say This investigation has profoundly changed the way I teach design to students. So, you know, in all my classes, this is a consideration, whether we're doing an interaction design class or maybe a more spatial design class or the information visualization courses, you know, thinking about that temporal experience, how the visualization unfolds, how, you know, how more details reveal themselves as you engage more deeply. I think this is, you know, this is a key point of critique that that has Stephen has helped me get to the point, and I you know, I look to carry it forward. I think just, you know, from the and on the fun side of things too, not that teaching's not fun, but we have, you know, we do some workshops together. You know, we've got a one planned coming up soon here in Pittsburgh. I think we're finalizing the dates for it now. And then there's another one planned for Boston, and I'm sure we'll have some more ongoing. But yeah, I think extending this conversation and looking for more people who are interested in this and willing to be involved.
Seeing you, I can feel that it's a very impactful way of thinking about design, and it's very, you seem so full of happiness to have created something very special, a very special perspective on design. And thank you again for this and talking about time. Thank you for taking the time to talk a little bit about this stuff. I hope we, at one point in time, we can come back together and talk about what changed over time and how also this perspective maybe has changed over the years, for example, would be also interesting. Yes, and thank you.
Yes, we would love that. Thank you so much. This has been a wonderful interview. It's been a real joy to meet you. And we hope that we'll get a chance to work with you again in the future, and anybody watching or listening, we hope to have more connections around the world. Thank you.
And you, dear listeners, you can read this wonderful book, Somaesthetic Design, The Experiencing Body and the Dynamics of Time, going to the Transkript Verlag in Germany, where you can download it for free or buy it for, I think, about $30 or 40, I'm not sure about it. But it's also for free, so take the chance and have a look into it. It's really, it's really something that brings you new perspectives into design research. And if you want to know more, we also put the links to Stephen and Michael into the show notes as well as to the book. I hope you enjoyed our little talk, and we'll hopefully talk to each other. You will hopefully hear us, me and my today missing team, talking to each other in about a month or 6 weeks or so. See you then. Bye bye. Was ist das? 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 Was ist das?